This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 28th of October 2014 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Grundig. Hello and welcome to Section D, the hour we devote to the world of design each week on Monocle 24. Today it's going to be me, David Pleasant, bringing you the show, standing in for Section D regular host Tom Morris. Coming up today, we're going back to Belgium, where the world's best interiors are put on show.
Here you have true design lovers. In a way, this has become the only very specifically targeting design fair that you have in Europe nowadays.
Plus, we take an even more exclusive tour of one very important building in New York, the headquarters of the UN.
The design itself has become the institution, and the institution is the design of the rooms.
And then we go to Berlin to get the insights from a master of menswear.
Of course, with my materials, they say to the wearer, you can wear me for 10 winters without failing you.
That's all here on Section D with me, David Pleasant, on Monocle 24. Now to start, we go to the Biennale Intérieur, held every 2 years in the Flemish city of Kortrijk. Started in 1968, the fair has gained a reputation for being the most respected of design fairs in this ever-growing circuit. This year, former editor of Domus, Joseph Grima, and his design research collaborative, Space Caviar, were guest curators. The theme they came up with was The Home Does Not Exist, a provocative call to arms for a homeware design trade fair. But as we heard last week, Kortrijk is much more than a fair. Grima wanted to question the function and role of the home in a critical way, and indeed many of the exhibitors and designers hope to do the same, in an albeit more subtle way. I went around the Biennale Intérieur in the hope of getting a feel for this very unique design gathering. I'm here right at the centre of Hall 4 of the Biennale Intérieur. One thing that seems to set the design fair apart from its rivals is the high level of attention paid to every aspect of all the exhibits. The Biennale is a non-profit organisation, and the two-year frequency also affords the organisers time and space to perfect the event. Exhibitors are talked through how to best display their concepts, while at the same time following the overall concept or mood of the surrounding hall and fair. Another unique aspect of the fair is something that is so often overlooked at such events, that is, the design of places to eat. Here at the Biennale, these spaces are integral to the design innovation and appreciation promoted by the fair. I'm going to meet Loïc Vermiche, the director, whose brainchild these eating opportunities are.
What we believe is the right experience when you eat here, namely a creative experience, a qualitative experience, and above all, you also reinforce coming here as a place of encounter. And that's why we really want to mix it in with the rest, but at the same time, absolutely make sure that the experience is fluid, is continuous, and you're never pulled away out of the dream, let's say. Here we're standing in front of the Dry Chat Room, which is one of the four bars, the pop-up bars, which is doing, let's say, all the things you're not supposed to do with materials and design. When I tell it like this, it sounds like really bad. And still, if you see it, it creates a really pleasant atmosphere. I think it's a good example of how it's interesting to also challenge a bit what's going on here. And here in front of us, we have combined with Moroso Artek. So that combination, that young talent challenging things, new companies standing up, and putting them together with some of the reference brands, that is for me, for example, a setting that best transmits what you can experience here.
And that important link between young, fresh design innovation and the commercial world of the big brands is something that is tangible here at the Biennale. I'm going to step up into the stand of Italian brand Moroso to meet CEO Roberto Moroso and his colleagues.
It's 20 years now that really is a different fair, is a unique fair of the north of Europe. And so I think Morozov was the first, and now Morozov continue to stay here because we know this difference. We are different. Like,
what's the difference? Can you explain the difference?
We speak with people, with distribution, with people together. And so we see in the same time what is the developing of the feeling with the product, with the market, and the distribution too, and not only in Belgium, but in Holland, in Germany. And so the answer is immediate. And so for us, it's very, very important.
I need to say one thing. Here you have design lovers, true design lovers. In a way, this has become the only very specifically targeting design fair that you have in Europe nowadays. It's very different from Milan. It's very different from what we have, for instance, in Cologne, where we go every year. So since 2 years ago, we are even more happy to continue to come here.
Now I'm making my way to Hall 3, where the Biennale's Designers of the Year take pride of place.
I'm Marina Bautier. I'm a furniture designer based in Brussels. And we stand here in the Hall 3 with an installation of all the designers of the years from this year back to 2006.
And the most prominent display is yours, of course, as you are the winner. Tell us about the winning entry, your work this year.
So I present here most of the work is from my own brand, MA, which I launched last year in May. And then some collaborations I have also with other brands such as Case Furniture from England, Suedese from Sweden, Ligne Rose from France, and Stadtmann New Mobile from Germany. I know the Biennale very well from visiting, but I've actually never exhibited here. And it's a bit special for me to exhibit on a fair with finished product as more of a commercial event. Until now, I had only exhibited in the Salone Satellite in Milan at the beginning of my career. So it's a bit of a different approach for me, but it's very nice to be able to show my work to the general public. I'd say that's really what's bringing to me to be here.
That engagement with other designers, perhaps designers of the future, and the public at large, is something that resounds here at the Biennale. And this is not least thanks to the Kortrijk City Programme, where the old centre of this medieval town plays host to Biennale events and gatherings. Down a quiet lane on the central Buda Island is an 18th century stable, where on the occasion of the Biennale, the worlds of theatre and architecture merge.
My name is Brecht Hoormans, I'm an architect, and I work together with Gert-Jan Stam. He's a theater maker under the name TAAT, which stands for Theater as Architecture, Architecture as Theater. The project that we're presenting on interior is Hall 03. It's a partial project of a long-term project in which we want to make a building that is a theater play and a theater play that is a building. So it's a research project in how architecture can reveal its narrative potential. We make installations where people walk in themselves, and we work with the form which is called DIY theater, so do-it-yourself theater, in which people are at the same time a performer and a spectator. So in this project, Hall 03, there's two parallel corridors in which you go in.
Can we go in?
So this is the horse stables. So we have 19 different spaces here in a parallel setup. So the idea is that in every space you enter together with this unknown other, you're separated from each other, you can't see each other from the start, and then you start discovering each other through the architecture. There's ways of different interactions between the two people and between the space. So we always ask ourselves, can architecture trigger people to behave in a certain way that it becomes a specific or a spontaneous acting?
Public engagement and a forum for experimentation, the Biennale also proves to be a platform for emerging design talent. In Hall 5 is the Interior Awards exhibition, where 20 objects from 20 designers that have not yet been picked up commercially are displayed.
My name is Tsuyoshi Hayashi, and my project is called Kawara Bench, and it is using the waste material from the local factory in Japan. I'm using defective rooftop tiles from the house. It has lots of defectives, and I just get rid of the defective part, trying to transform useless objects to useful matters. That is the point of my design.
So it's a ceramic tile, yeah, framed on a wooden structure. Yeah. My first question, it's beautiful, yeah, but it does look a bit fragile.
No, actually, this is a typical question I could have it from the audience, but actually I've already tested with people. And for example, my single chair can support until 120 kilograms. because the way they fire in Japan is they're using like a more higher temperature, more than 1,200 degrees. So it's going to be really high, you know, tense and really strong material.
Kortrijk is a great opportunity for international design talent, but the Biennale also remains a great regional platform. To end my tour, I went back to the director, Loïc Vermeersch, and asked him a very difficult question: how to define Belgian design.
If you stand, for example, within the exhibition of the Belgian designers, one thing I think you cannot put in black and white, of course, it is a very difficult question, but there's an element of kind of sometimes restraint. It's not in your face. If you compare it, for example, to Dutch design, we speak the same language, but it's culturally very different.
Dutch Design Week is happening kind of simultaneously. Yeah.
But there you have much more design which is more, I would say, loud, sometimes yelling. Whereas Belgian design, I think, is telling things a bit more subtlety. It's not better or worse, it's different. And that, I think, is one element that many of them have together, is subtlety, which releases its quality when you really get interaction with it. And it's something I can sort of see also in the way people are connecting. Belgium maybe is not at the first sentences really, hey, and slap on the shoulder, how are you? But there's maybe a more subtle approach. But when you really get into it, it's warm, it's deep, and often also spiritual.
For Monocle, in Kortrijk, Belgium, I'm David Pleasant. You're listening to Section D with me, David Pleasant. Now we venture east for a very different design gathering. South Korean fashion has finally found a home. Over the past 14 years, Seoul Fashion Week was more or less a wandering gypsy, taking place inside either a shopping mall or a drab convention centre. But now it has a venue to call its own. We sent our Seoul correspondent, Jason Strother, over to Fashion Week to check out these new digs.
The Dongdaemun neighbourhood has long been the heart of South Korea's textile and garment industry, and until 2008, an old sports stadium stood right in its centre. But now, the newly opened, metallic, flying saucer-like Dongdaemun Design Plaza now stands in its spot, and it's where Seoul Fashion Week has taken up residence. Cameras click away inside one of the exhibition halls as models do laps around the showroom. The creations of 75 South Korean designers are featured during the fall edition of Fashion Week. Some of those include Ko Tae-young, Lee Sang-bon, and Jung Do-young. Previous Fashion Weeks felt more like an industry-only event, but now, thanks to its new home at the Dongdaemun Design Plaza, or DDP, anyone can drop in and check out what's on the runways. That's what Lee Hyun-ju, one of the event's organizers, tells me. We speak in front of the plaza's outdoor stage.
The DDP is the permanent home of Seoul Fashion Week because this area, Dongdaemun, is the mecca of the Korea's fashion. So this is the area where Korea's fashion starts from. So we have a lot more opportunities here.
Lee says as Fashion Week has grown, it's created new opportunities for designers to show their creations to overseas buyers too.
The Seoul Fashion Week is getting more international attention because there are a lot of requests and interest from the buyers, especially in the Chinese region and also in European or the American region.
Why do you think Chinese buyers have so much interest in Korean fashion?
It's also influenced by the K-pop or the K-wave, the Hallyu. And also, interesting thing is that the men's fashion, the men's designers are getting more attention. Chinese buyers are more interested in the men's designers and fashion.
One of those male designers is 37-year-old Hwang Jae-kun, who started his Jae-kun clothing line 3 years ago. I meet him backstage after his show.
Hi. Hi, maybe we should go out here.
Huang tells me how he got started in the business.
My mother was actually a fashion designer, and I saw this kind of influence, but I didn't realize. But when I was first year in university, and I sudden moment, I don't know, I wanted to involve in the fashion world. So after I graduated, and then I went to the Antwerp Academy of Fine Art, and I graduated, and then it was the first Korean graduation. And after I came back to Seoul, and I built my company.
Huang shows me some of his latest designs featured in his catalog.
What are you most proud of here?
Could you
give me a couple examples of what you're really happy with?
Everything is my children. Each season we are doing some kind of prints. And also material is very special. That kind of, the material is usually using for the shoes or bag. But I translate to the garment.
Canvas?
Yeah.
Okay.
And some of the detail is also usually garment don't use, but I take and make piece to wearable.
What do you think about the new venue for the Seoul Fashion Week, the Design Plaza?
I mean, the Seoul Fashion Week is always, it's quite open to change the location, but I like this location because of the steady and there is a lot of possibility. People easily can access, and also it's open to not only fashion people, but also to everyone. So I quite like this location.
Huang is obviously not the only one who likes the new location. Around 60,000 people have come to this fashion week. And amongst those in attendance is fashion blogger Kim Jina, whose YouTube videos get around 10,000 hits. I pull her out of the crowd and into a cafe to chat about fashion week and its new home.
I think the atmosphere is much more festive right now.
She says along with the new venue, Korean fashion tastes have changed too. And they're on display here at Fashion Week, both on and off the stage.
I think a few years ago, lots of people really cared about, if I wear this, what people would think about me. So they wanted to look same. But right now, it's the opposite. People want to look different from other people. So they have their own personal style, and I really like that.
Kim, who's 26, says she won't make her viewers wait much longer for her review of Fashion Week.
I'm going to make a video about street fashion and my personal style during the Seoul Fashion Week.
What are you wearing? What does a young fashion blogger and YouTuber wear to Seoul Fashion Week? Tell me what you have on today.
I think it's all about patterns. But lots of people, when I look around, they wear like flower prints or window pane prints. There's lots of prints. Hats, maybe?
Yeah, what's
fedora
on?
And beanie.
Since no one besides you and me can see your hat, tell me what kind of hat you're wearing today.
Yeah, I'm wearing my blue collar beanie, and there's a black letter on it. It's called black.
With or without her blue beanie, Kim Jina will be back at the Dongdaemun Design Plaza in March for the next Seoul Fashion Week. For Monocle in Seoul, I'm Jason Strother.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, where we'll return after this short break.
For over six decades, Grundig has made people's lives better and simpler. To this day, we bring our expert knowledge of design and technology to a wide range of high-quality domestic appliances. Whether refrigerator or radio, oven or audio system, we continue to integrate our manufacturing heritage with state-of-the-art technology. Grundig synthesizes the best of yesterday with the best of tomorrow, expertly and innovatively designed for you and your home. Grundig. Supreme engineering, timeless design.
Next to New York. The UN Security Council Chamber and the General Assembly have been part of a refurbishment project, the Capitol Master Plan. The chamber was completed last year and the General Assembly just a few months ago. But little has changed. In fact, the Security Council is almost completely the same as when it was inaugurated in 1952, a gift from Norway overseen by architect Arnstein Arnberg. The reason? Well, politics. Monocle's New York bureau chief, Ed Stocker, visited the UN headquarters in the city to find out more. This week, he speaks to Assistant Secretary General Michael Adlerstein, himself an architect. And next week, he'll interview Norwegian consul Xenia Chrysostomidis about Norway's design legacy and its enduring contribution to what is arguably the most important room in the world.
The Capital Master Plan is the opportunity for the UN to renew itself. After 9/11, the mayor of New York came here and said that if we have to send in our firefighters, you must meet code. You must at least be safe from day-to-day activities. So we now meet code. We're a much higher level of technology. We are much greener and more sustainable. We're more blast resistant. And we use half the energy that we used to use.
How easy is it in a place like this where compromise, where nations are meeting, how easy is it to change the design?
This is not an easy place. The UN is a combination of every culture in the world, every single culture in the world. So there's a great deal of differing opinions on every aspect of the renovation. It was an unusual task. I've worked on complex projects with congressional clients, but this was far more diverse. It was the points of view that were far more diverse than anything I've ever come across. But it's workable. They are professional diplomats. They do understand that the project must move forward. And I had very strong support from the Secretary General, which allowed us to proceed.
If we talk about the Security Council, that was the hardest in terms of change, wasn't it? Explain a little bit why perhaps the members of the Security Council, the permanent members, are reluctant to change things.
The Security Council is very, very conservative. It does still have the leather placemats that it had when we were using wet ink for taking our notes. And they love that sense of legacy and of posterity. But they also, especially some of the members, are very hesitant to start down the slippery slope of change, and that they would rather stay with everything that they have. We were able to impose certain technological changes, like better microphones, air conditioning, heating systems, better video conferencing capabilities, better electronics overall. But all the seats are the original seats reupholstered. The table is the actual table refinished. The carpet is the exact same carpet. The number of seats is exactly the same, and exactly the same location for all the seats.
And why do you think that there's a reluctance for change? Do you think that change might mean other things are questioned, like the political makeup of the Security Council itself?
I think there's a sense that it's working. And I think that's the fear, is that something different might not work as well. That there is a sense that we have almost 70 years without a world war. And that's a very positive thing. And that's what the UN was created for, was to avoid World War III. And it's in that very basic sense, it has been successful. And the Security Council is fearful about changing that chemistry.
You've got an architectural background. Let's talk a little bit about the design and the features of the Security Council. Obviously, Norwegian designed, and despite the fact that it hasn't changed since 1952, still kind of very much in vogue in a way, no?
I think very much in vogue. I think it created vogue, and therefore time has stayed with it as being elegant. It is a very subdued, elegant design that's been, I think, captured in people's minds as representing a powerful conference room. And I think people see it often enough on television and in a few movies that they recognize it as being a serious place of serious discussion, and therefore it stays in style. Unlike a place which is a very well-designed place of entertainment, it changes, and it changes continuously. This is like many wonderful works of design where the design itself has become the institution, and the institution is the design of the rooms. They've always decided to retain this facility. In the 1990s, they voted to retain the facility rather than tear it down. In the 40s, they built it. In the 90s, they voted to continue it and not tear it down and have the Capital Master Plan renew it and not lose the iconic meaning of this compound.
Tell us about some of the issues. For example, I think the Security Council, when it originally opened, had windows facing the East River. That's now been replaced, or replaced for some time now, by blackout blinds. Why that decision to kind of block out the external daylight?
I think an interesting aspect of technology is that sometimes technology creates unwanted side effects. The movement from still cameras to television cameras made the view of the river impossible. The view of the river was the determining factor in placing the conference rooms facing east towards the East River. However, that view became impossible because the camera required equal lighting over everyone. Otherwise, some people were favored by sunlight while others were in shade. At different times of day, that would change, and it was all very unpredictable and undemocratic in the truest sense. So the blackout shades were imposed, artificial lighting was brought up and made much more powerful, and the cameras are happy. The cameras capture everyone looking at their best. So the good looks are evenly distributed.
Can you just tell us about the General Assembly Hall, because that's the most recently completed of the refurbishment projects. Tell us a little bit about what's changed and what you've been doing in that room.
We just completed the General Assembly Hall, actually within days of when the heads of state came to town last month in mid-September. We had a wonderful, successful general debate, as the September debate is called, where there were no glitches and everything worked well and the rooms functioned. And the major difference in the General Assembly Hall, which was done because of the continuous dissecting of the world into smaller parcels, is that we now have 193 countries. We established a unofficial survey of the ambassadors, which we conducted. We decided that we needed at least 10 more seats for future countries. So we have placed additional seating in the General Assembly Hall for future countries that are going to be established or might be established. But otherwise, it's very much the same. It has better electronics and heating and lighting and all the things that we did in the other buildings.
That was Monocle's New York Bureau Chief, Ed Stocker, bringing us that from inside the UN headquarters. We'll be hearing more on the role of Norway in the design history of the UN with Ed next week. Still to come on Section D, we'll be getting more architectural insights from New York, as we have one of our regular updates. We'll then swap New York for Detroit, via London, as the iconic American brand and favourite of Monocle, Shinola, sets up shop in the UK. Before we go to Berlin to meet menswear designer Frank Leder. And now we go back to New York for an update on what's new and what's coming up in the world of architecture. From an important museum in Cambodia to a bridge with a difference in Washington, D.C. Alan Brake, the executive editor of the Architects newspaper, spoke to Emily Elias. He began by describing plans for Zaha Hadid's Siluk Reet Institute in Phnom Penh.
So it's a series of five towers that are separated at the base, but then branch out at the top and become joined, and you can sort of move from one building to the next on the upper floors. And the architects have said that it draws somewhat of its inspiration from Angkor Wat.
How connected is this museum to the history of Cambodia? What kind of elements of design have they tried to employ in this?
Well, again, you know, the inspiration from these ancient sites, you know, it also uses wood and natural materials in a way that Zaha Hadid is not particularly known for. So I think she's drawing on the context of that place in maybe a way that she's not typically known for. You know, it's a really powerful symbol of Cambodia dealing with its troubled past, dealing with its history of genocide, and trying to kind of reckon with that as a way of moving forward. And I think that's a very optimistic symbol for a country like Cambodia.
The architect herself met with some controversy recently. How is this project being received?
It's being very well received. And as you say, I mean, I think it sort of comes at a good time for her. She's made some comments recently that have been at least perceived of as being somewhat insensitive on various human rights issues. So, you know, the fact that this project has come along and that she's embraced it and produced something so powerful, I think certainly comes at a good time for her.
I guess moving on, we're going from a very beautiful building to a bridge that has a new life. Can you tell me a bit about this bridge in Washington, D.C.?
So it is a disused bridge across the Anacostia River, and it's a series of kind of remnant piers. And what's been proposed is a new bridge that's a kind of hybrid landscape and piece of architecture that bridges across these piers. And it's a very kind of dynamic design. It's a sort of series of folding planes, which have green roofs and incorporate different uses. So it's meant to be a very kind of dynamic place that draws people from the Navy Yard in Washington to Anacostia Park.
This bridge had a previous life, and we've seen other bridges, like in New York, that have now taken on new life. Why are so many architects leaning towards this sort of trend of reusing old infrastructure?
You know, that's an interesting question. This design is by OMA, Rem Koolhaas's firm, working with Philadelphia landscape architecture firm Olin, both of whom, you know, have long and illustrious careers. But they're here tapping into, as you say, this kind of larger trend of reusing infrastructure, finding new uses, kind of adapting old portions of the city for contemporary life. I think it just sort of speaks to the way that people are living and rethinking cities. It's happening all over the world, so it's a very positive trend for cities.
And this bridge in particular, it looks like it's not just something to use to cross over the water. It looks more of like a destination, trying to make it a hub for people to meet and socialize.
Yeah, absolutely. And another thing, just to put it in context, I mean, it's in Washington, D.C., which is, you know, known to be a fairly conservative and staid architectural environment. So, I mean, I think this is certainly has the potential to change the way people think about Washington, you know, and there has been an uptick in the sort of design ambitions in Washington. And this is certainly an example of that.
Is this the first of many trends that we're going to start seeing around the world?
Well, yeah, no, I think that's certainly a possibility. I think, you know, the idea of landscape and architecture coming together and being more closely linked is something that is also very important and is a sort of major emerging trend. It's been going on for a while, but the division between those two things, I think, is really eroding.
And shall we move on to Paris? And a top architect has really done a great job with the foundation Louis Vuitton.
Yes, of course, Frank Gehry is having a sort of late career moment here with what is being heralded almost universally as a kind of masterpiece in his already illustrious career. So I think people have come to associate him with, you know, titanium, with hard metal buildings. This is keeps some of the sort of sculptural shapes, but it's these sort of beautiful floating glass sails, and it's in a park setting, and it's just incredibly beautiful. I can't wait to see it myself in person.
It opens at the end of the month. What kind of reaction has it been getting?
As I said, you know, it's been pretty universally praised. I mean, you know, these kinds of museums, you know, that are privately funded by, you know, very wealthy collectors, you know, often can be sort of ego-driven and run the risk of being these sort of trophy projects. I think this is really being seen as a gift to Paris, you know, and a new major destination for that city.
And finally, what is something that you're looking forward to?
So coming up at the beginning of November is the Istanbul Design Biennial. This is a new exhibition. I think this is either the second or third time they've done it. And each year it seems to kind of gather a little bit more attention. Obviously, the fact that it's in Istanbul, given the Arab Spring and given the sort of free speech and public space issues there, I think the designers who are in the show will have some really interesting responses to the contemporary city and to design in that part of the world.
Any sneak peeks of what particularly you're looking forward to seeing there?
They don't tell you a lot. The curator is named Zoe Ryan, and she's well-known. She's the chief architecture and design curator at the Art Institute in Chicago, and she has a very wide international network, so I'm always curious to see what she brings to the table.
That was Alan Brake, the executive editor of the Architects newspaper, speaking to Emily Elias a little earlier. You're listening to Section D, brought to you by me, David Pleasant. Detroit-based brand Shinola has landed on Britain's shores. The American watch, leather and bicycle manufacturer will officially open its doors to its fourth shop and first international branch in London, Soho on the 30th of October. Founded in 2011, the lifestyle brand settled in Detroit to revive the region's industrial legacy by creating handmade, high-quality products built to last. Monocle got the insights of Shinola's creative director, Daniel Cordill, at the new shop, which is seconds from department store Liberty, which will also be carrying the brand come Christmas.
The idea behind the brand was really about bringing manufacturing back to the United States, making quality product, really the idea of who's behind the brand, who's behind the product, and it's really the maker and bringing craftsmanship to the forefront. And the more you learn about Detroit and what was made there and what was designed there, and you know, it was the seat of manufacturing, not only for the United States, but for the world. There were so many different types of products that were made over, you know, the past 100 years in Detroit. And it's really a great legacy. And that was sort of the idea behind why we opened the factory in Detroit. It has such a history of manufacturing that it's just sort of in the blood of the people. And it's sort of a natural for us to build our factory there. The factory in Detroit really is a state-of-the-art factory. The watch factory is, it's an amazing place, and it's really exciting every time I go through the factory and really see what they're doing and how intricate and detailed it is to make a watch and how many hands touch that watch. Part of the design process is also making product that doesn't have all the bells and whistles. It's really about the function and the use and really the bare essentials of what you need and creating product that isn't frivolous, that it's useful and it's purposeful in your life and that everything here has a purpose. We were talking about the store last night when we were getting it all set up, and Sam, who's the store manager, said, you walk down the street and it feels warm and it feels inviting and it feels like someplace you want to just come and hang out. And that's really what we want people to do. We want them to come in, we want to touch the watch and touch the leather and feel the quality of that watch. And really, once you feel the leather and you can see the quality behind it, you understand what's behind the brand. And I think that's the most important thing, is to create an environment where people can feel comfortable to just come in and hang out and get to know the product, get to know the brand.
That was creative director at Shinola, Daniel Cordill, as the brand opened its new store in London's Soho.
At Grundig, we carefully craft equipment to help you make the most out of your kitchen, which is why we named our new oven and hob appliance collection, We Care. Our multi-taste oven uses three currents of hot air to cook different dishes simultaneously, with 13 cooking functions to choose from and an LCD display. It's one example of how we strive to perfect our technological innovation so that you can enjoy your home, meal after meal. Grundig. Supreme engineering, timeless design.
You're listening to Section D with me, David Pleasant. If you were listening just before the break, you'll have heard of Detroit-based brand Shinola. Now, you could do worse than matching your Shinola purchases with the label in our next feature. Berlin-based menswear designer Frank Leder is inspired by Germanness, the country's rites, rituals and folkways that are little known outside the country. His garments have their roots in the workwear of carpenters, butchers and ordinary sailors. This strong aesthetic interest in his home country sprang from his time studying at London's Central St. Martin's, when he discovered a cache of antique German books in a local market. High quality, hand-worked, and made from fine vintage fabrics and materials, Frank Leder's designs generate cult-level adoration in Japan, as well as fans in the US and Europe. For Monocle, Susan Stone paid a visit to his studio in Berlin's Charlottenburg neighbourhood.
At the moment, we're standing in front of a table which probably contains about 160 glass jars from the 1950s, filled with fruits and vegetables, like conserved. And this was discovered by a friend of mine, an artist friend of mine in Leipzig, in some basement. And at the moment, these kind of pieces don't really form a starting point for a collection, but they could be in the future. And that's just an example now for like all the things I collect.
One could say that there are a lot of commonalities with the color palette that you often use yourself. Is that the type of thing that you would find kind of inspirational?
I guess it's kind of muted tones, earthy tones play an important role in my work. Fabrics anyway as a starting point for every collection I make. But normally I keep this tone because I use quite a lot of different colors and quite a lot of different fabric styles. by using maybe 40, maybe 50 different fabrics in a collection is quite difficult. I mean, the fabrics, especially in winter times, have to be sturdy, they have to be hardworking, they have to be thick wool. Or I have like one fabric called Deutschleder, which is not a leather like you would expect from the name. It's a very, very heavy cotton fabric. And we have to use leather machines to sew it, otherwise the needles would always break. Of course, with my materials, they say to the wearer, you can wear me for 10 winters without failing you, you know.
You mentioned finding books about Germany, mm-hmm. or German books, in the flea market or in the markets in London when you were studying there. Mm-hmm. Was there a sense for you of being also a German out of Germany, like these books, sort of viewed in a different way and seeing your own culture in a different way?
Mm-hmm. For sure, yeah. It was a starting point for doing themes maybe about some special cultures of Germany. But men's societies, I'm quite interested. I'm a menswear designer, so it's like, of course, I'm interested in this kind of like rules and special bonding kind of like ways.
Rituals.
Yeah, rituals. And sometimes I will do a collection based on this kind of special circles of men or people. Last summer, as an example, I was having this collection about the German carpenters on the Walz, as we say. They need to not come back to the home place after they leave for this kind of journey, which takes 3 years in one day. They are banned to go inside their hometown for, I think it's like 20 kilometers. When they start, they have to climb over the village sign and they have to dig a hole and put a bottle of schnapps, of liquor inside. Because when they come back after 3 years and one day, that's the first thing they do, they dig it out and drink it.
These carpenters still wander around, and you see them even in Berlin, and there's a very specific look that they have, what they wear. Can you describe that?
Not all of them are dressed in black corduroy, but most of them, the carpenters too, they have big brimmed hats. All the belongings are being stuffed in one big scarf, which is printed with kind of like traditional... yeah, imagery of this kind of like carpenters. For this collection, we have actually like reprinted one with our symbols. So I'm appearing on it as a carpenter, and that's quite nice. And so basically, all the belongings are inside this bag, which is called Charlottenburger. Interesting enough, like the area we are at the moment here, my studio is called Charlottenburg, and it actually comes really from this area. All that information is quite nice, I think. And then you can base a collection on it and you can kind of like, tell a beautiful story and introduce maybe like my customers to a piece of German culture they wouldn't have known without me telling it to them. So that's something really rewarding. And the garments come to it as well. So it's all comes together at the end, you know.
When we think about pulling examples from German history, that's can be very weighted activity.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Working with German culture is, of course, or like something which is very rewarding for me, to dig out these bubbles of like culture which are floating around and which are not affected or abused by certain places in German history. When it's like Third Reich, for example, which was heavily abusing German culture, and that's what you're talking about, taking a lot of this kind of like really innocent or like really kind of interesting cultural references and abusing it into their kind of like regime or their cultural, not, you shouldn't say culture, as a kind of propaganda machine, right? It's of course very much difficult to kind of wash it clear of this kind of sediment, you know? But since there's always interesting, even like directly related pockets to this kind of time, for example, a new collection I will base on Leipziger Meuten, which was an underground resistance group in Leipzig, out of like a youth gang, basically. And I very much liked the story and the history and the kind of like theme about it. So probably it will appear very pretty soon in one of my collections, yeah.
Shall we go look at some clothes? Yeah.
So talking about the sturdy kind of like heavy garments, That is the archive collection, I call it. It's like a very small collection of around 25 pieces, which can be ordered or custom made. That's fabrics I really like to work with. We have like the Austrian wool, we have the Deutschleder I mentioned before, this is kind of heavy cotton
fabric.
Yeah,
this is very stiff.
It will get softer, but it's, the first year will be a challenge.
Yeah. Oh, I think, and these trousers are also made from it?
Oh, yeah.
I think they could stand up on their own.
Yeah, they do actually. You'd be surprised how much people actually like the garments of Deutschleder, and we are selling a lot in Japan. Like, we can sell like hundreds of.
And in your main collection or in your seasonal collections, mm-hmm. what's the sort of price range?
Around 250 to 300 for a trouser, 180 to 250 for a shirt, jackets start 500, I would say, coats 800. So we are quite pricey, but it really depends on the fabric itself, you know. There are, of course, cheaper pieces as well inside, but the sheer craftsmanship and that we really try to produce everything in Germany and keep everything under our control costs a lot of money, you know, because I really want to be fair to the seamstresses and the people who sew my garments. And it's worth it, I think, to kind of like invest in people and pay them more and then get the reward in terms of quality or understanding even.
That was Susan Stone meeting menswear designer Frank Leder at his studio in Berlin. And to end this episode of Section D, we go from one studio to another. Earlier this week, Monocle's Gaia Lutz paid a visit to Mizuyo Yamashita's ceramic studio. Mizuyo, a Japanese ceramicist based in London, has been using centuries-old Asian techniques and fusing them with European aesthetics. The end product, delicate and discreet tableware. In her studio, she explained what kind of environment makes it possible for her to craft her intricate pieces. Gaia met Mizuyo at her tranquil studio in Hackney's Broadway Market here in London.
Can you tell me a little about your day when you come into the office? What are the first things you do every day?
The first thing I do is to make a tea and to clear my throat. I usually wake up really early, like 6 o'clock in the morning, and I do all the computer work before coming to the studio. When I'm in the studio, I don't have a computer or I don't check Facebook or anything like that. I just focus on making.
Where would you say you get your inspiration from?
Usually it's when I'm cooking and eating with friends, that sort of stuff. When I try new dishes or something like that, I get this image how to serve this dish and in what kind of shapes or designs.
It's quite a big space. What is the place you're most at? What is your desk of work?
At the moment, I usually work on the wheel. I spend half of the day on the wheel, and then because I carve, so I work half of the day on the table. One day I throw a shape, next day I turn the shape, and then depending on the process I apply to the pot, I work on the surface straight away or I leave it for another night, something like that. Usually we do two firings. One is bisque firing and to low temperature, usually about 1,000 degree. And then we glaze pot after that. And then we fire to, well, it depends on the makers, but between 1040 to 1250. I do stoneware, so I fire to 1250.
It's very meticulous and slow and patient work. What do you think are the important things in your environment to make sure you're in that mind state and focus?
It's important to keep the space relatively clean. And good meal definitely helps your mindset. Of course, it's really important to focus on what you're doing. So it's sometimes rude, but I sometimes don't take phone calls. Also, the reason is because most of the time my hands are in the mud, so I can't take phone calls. It's funny, like someday my throwing skill is really good, but some days rubbish. When my throwing skill is rubbish, I just don't force myself and I do other jobs so that I don't waste my time trying to do something I cannot do. But when I'm in a good mood and then a good throwing speed, I just to push that as much as I can.
How would you describe your design?
My style, maybe it's a somewhere between Western and Japanese, because I use Japanese techniques often, but because of the different food culture, I know I can't make Japanese shapes. What I tend to do subconsciously, maybe at the moment, is starting from making English pottery and then applying this Japanese technique.
And finally, you said it's a very focused work, but do you listen to some music in your office space?
Okay, yes, I do. Actually, I love Brazilian music, so I listen to often bossa nova, but sometimes samba when I need to keep going at night. In the morning, when I'm still in low tone, I listen to more jazzy music. My favorite is, of course, like Tom Jobim.
That was Gaia Lutz at the studio of Japanese ceramicist Mizuyo Yamashita. And that's about all we have time for on Section D. Today's show was edited by Alex Funnell, and I'm David Pleasant. You can contact me at dmp@monocle.com if you want to feature on the show or have any comments or questions. And playing you out, and inspired by the working day of Mizuyo Yamashita, we have the wonderful Antonio Carlos Jobim with Gisavinado. Thanks for listening. Thank you.